5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
We've become a nation of haves and have-nots. We saw that so much over the weekend. WA has now gone 120 days without community transmission of COVID, and we are now being lauded as the pin-up for containment, something that only New Zealand has been congratulated for. Over the weekend, hands up, who of you was at the pub? Who went to the footy at Optus Stadium or to the Waffle, or at a party of more than 10, picking at a grazing table while talking about the borders? I know I was, because life just seems to continue on as it always has. And I feel I've become so complacent, and I keep having to check myself to remind us that we're living in unprecedented times. Queensland this morning is waiting with bated breath to see if those border crossing nuffies who are COVID-19 positive has spread the virus around. The state has gone 7 days without any transmission, but we're waiting to see if that magic number 14 days reaps any numbers. Meanwhile, Victoria this morning has recorded our deadliest day in Australia since the pandemic began. 19 people have died and 322 new cases have been confirmed. But as the WA government and the Doctors Association here keep saying, we are not out of the woods. And if you think COVID hasn't impacted us, it has. We may have got lucky with the spread of coronavirus, but that lockdown drove us all to drink. 45% of us hit the bottle due to stress and anxiety, and those issues will have a far greater consequence on all of us over the coming months. We've got a massive show today, so let's get into it.
The West Live. The West Live with Jenna Clark.
Joining me this morning is the Minister for Child Protection here in WA, Simone McGuirk. This morning, the government have made a brand new announcement of over $700,000 to help trial Aboriginal family-led decision-making when it comes to children in care, and she joins me now. Good morning, Minister. What can you tell us about this new funding that will be allocated to Aboriginal families?
Hi, Jenna. Great to be with you. The announcement we've made this morning is to trial some money a new involvement of Aboriginal families as well as their community sector organisations, Aboriginal-led community sector organisations, mm-hmm. to be involved in the in child protection issues. So this is sort of the planning and decision making, particularly around placement of Aboriginal children. Essentially, what happens now is that Aboriginal children are vastly overrepresented in our child protection system. So yes. I think they're about 3% of our population, Aboriginal people, but about 56% of our children in child protection in care of the department are Aboriginal. So we've currently got some changes through working through the parliament, some changes to the child protection legislation, which would involve represent increased involvement of Aboriginal organisations in placement decisions. But this trial around a model called Aboriginal family-led decision-making takes that a step further and would actually mean, I guess, a representation of self-determination for Aboriginal people in regard to child protection. Child safety is at the safety of any is at the centre of any decision, so that's not compromised. That's the sort of benchmark of whether a child should or shouldn't be taken into care isn't altered, but it's really who is involved in that decision and how we involve the broader family, the Aboriginal community and Aboriginal organisations to participate in that decision making. And the money we've allocated is for a trial around Aboriginal family-led decision making.
So the trial is for about 2 years with a plan to potentially kick it on further, just a little bit over $700,000. It doesn't seem like a lot of money, but I guess how will this roll out in reality? What will be the changes that people will see on the ground?
Well, we'll commission some, and we've already actually begun doing this anyway. This just adds a bit of extra new money into the system. But we'll commission some Aboriginal experts to help us work through what that model might be and probably more than one area. Mm-hmm. So it might be that we do some planning around children, babies that would have come into care. What's the decision making around that?
Sure.
And what's the sort of supports in place, either for keeping the children, the baby with the mother, with the birth family, or if it is to go to another family, what's the kind of cultural supports and connection of that baby,
sure,
and the carers with the broader family and Aboriginal community and culture. The Royal Commission into Child Sex Abuse found that Aboriginal children, identity to culture was an important protective factor, mm-hmm, for those children. So the changes in the legislation, as well as family led decision making trial, is all recognising that we have to do better. I mean, there's not absolutely no doubt about it. We have to do better, and we will not improve the outcomes with Aboriginal children without the involvement of Aboriginal leaders, mm, and Aboriginal community, and strengthening the identity and connection to culture and country for Aboriginal kids.
Absolutely. And I guess a lot of groups have been calling for this for quite some time. And I know that you have been quite vocal about this, specifically in Parliament, saying that there were some changes coming, and Aboriginal people have always been involved in this sort of decision making. But I guess it just sort of solidifies it, and just to see how it goes. How will these certain Aboriginal experts be chosen to take part?
Well, we'll do that in conjunction with Aboriginal groups. So there are a couple of structures now in place in different parts of the state where we can consult with Aboriginal people involved in the child protection systems, mm-hmm, and services that are involved, and talk to them about who would be appropriate. So they'll be consulted in that model. We already have a form of family-led decision-making, Aboriginal family-led decision-making, in some of our early intervention contracts. Mm-hmm. So people might be familiar with Wanjining, which is the old Aboriginal Drug and Alcohol Authority. That that leads a consortium which is doing some early intervention work with Aboriginal families. And early days, but the results are looking quite promising, of keeping children safe, but also keeping giving those families some assistance to get on top of their issues and to stay stable and happy and healthy, mm-hmm, which is what we want. So we've already got a form of that already existing in our early intervention work. Aboriginal family-led decision-making is already in place in Victoria and Queensland, but interestingly, they're slightly different models.
Right.
So we'll have a look at, we'll work with Aboriginal groups to look at those different models and decide what's best for WA in agreement with them.
And I guess
the idea about the trial is that we try different things and then evaluate it. And if it's working, of course, we'd love to extend it out.
Yeah.
If not, we'll reset.
That's the thing, I guess, with this sort of any type of community-led response, because there are so many Indigenous communities in Western Australia. Something that is right for, say, up in the Kimberley is not going to suit, say, the community down in the southwest. So I guess it's an interesting time just to see what works, and it won't be a one-size-fits-all approach.
Exactly, and that's been one of the challenges for Western Australia, is the size of our state, state and the number of different language groups.
Mm.
And I think the maturity of Aboriginal organisations throughout the state to take on some of this work, and that's no criticism at all. We as a government system and as a state, we haven't really invested in the development of those organisations.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was over in Queensland, that's what the Aboriginal the head of the Aboriginal organisations there said, look, we took the better part of 10 years to develop up the kind of infrastructure of Aboriginal organisations to help partner with us, to help support them develop, so that they've obviously got the cultural authority and the cultural knowledge, but they also understood some of the other considerations that need to be sort of centre of thinking with when you're talking about child safety.
For sure.
So we're absolutely committed to doing that. We've just got to make sure the structures are in place and that we evaluate what we do. We don't just sort of go on hunches or just go on a wing and a prayer. We actually have to evaluate what we're doing. Is this better than what we're doing now. Is this an improvement? And as I said, if it is, then we're absolutely committed to extending it out.
That's fantastic. Well, I look forward to hearing how that goes. I guess from one childcare issue to another, we've had the Grattan Institute come out today saying that the government should increase the subsidy for childcare to 60% for families, bringing fees down to something like $20 a day because it's going to add something like $5 billion into the economy. What's your take on that? As I guess you're also the Women's Interest Minister as well.
Yeah, that's right. It is a big issue. We, as Women's Interest Minister and also the state government regulates childcare. So we have a lot of involvement with individual centres in that regard to make sure they're safe and they're operating according to their regulations. Well, as many have observed, the pandemic has shown us that when we really need to, we can change things quite radically and quite quickly. And this is a great opportunity for the Australian community and the federal government to have a look at this issue. There's no doubt about it that availability, proximity and affordability. So childcare needs to be sort of close by and sort of readily available in geographic terms, but also affordable for families to really access it. And time and again, it's shown to be the biggest barrier to increasing women's involvement in the workforce. Mm. And it'd be fantastic if we could look at a radical rethink of this. At the moment, we've got education that is, universally available, universal access is essentially free for all families. But that's not the case with childcare. And it's not only important for women's participation in the workforce and to have choice, it wouldn't be mandated, of course, it's still about choice, but it's also very important for child development. It gives real opportunities for capturing some challenges that we've got in the early years, particularly with vulnerable families, and we were just talking about those vulnerable communities before.
Absolutely.
So an ability to link in with services to make sure health checks are done, all those sorts of things, but also the kind of connection, the language development, all those, that neural development that occurs in the early years. Time and time again, we hear that investment in those early years will pay dividends through the lifetime, and we struggle to do that, but availability of childcare would be the single biggest boost to that. So, of course, I would welcome a complete rethink of that by the federal government. And this is not just a sort of worthy idea of saying, oh, we want women to work, wouldn't that be a great thing? Mm. The studies have shown that this would also pay dividends economically, that we are untapped when it comes to, we're undercooked when it comes to accessing the resources that are women in our community, and giving people choice in their career paths and in what sort of work that they undertake, and then to get the economic benefits, and I think, frankly, some many social benefits as well if we were to make that available.
Yeah, absolutely. And I incorrectly stated before, it wouldn't add just an extra $5 billion. If the Feds tipped in an extra $5 billion, that would see an extra $11 billion floating through the economy, which is fantastic. I guess if this all goes ahead and they do heed the call to basically take a massive rethink of it, will childcare for you be a bit of an election platform moving forward into March next year for you?
Well, the issue is for us, the state government, that we regulate it. So we oversee the adherence to, safety guidelines, ratios of carers and the like. But the federal government funds the childcare system. So this really is a choice for the federal government at the moment. And it was an issue in the last federal election. There was a lot of issues in the last federal election, but there were various commitments by both parties. I know Labor made a big commitment in terms of lowering the income threshold where a childcare would be essentially free for families. But there was a lot of issues in that federal election. It didn't get a lot of attention.
So I
think just tinkering, making some adjustments can have unintended consequences. So what was happening in the last injection during COVID, when there was JobKeeper, which I support being kept into childcare, but also they reduced the subsidy, the childcare benefit going in, is that childcare centres were then sort of challenged, because even though they had free childcare, they had full access of their services. They were in full demand, but they weren't getting full income because they weren't able to charge the families.
Yeah.
So it was great for families, but I know the centres, which are obviously many times operating on a very thin margin, the community-based and some of the privates as well, they were really struggling. And so local government provides a bit of some of the childcare offerings, and they weren't able to access JobKeeper. So when you operate, when you make those quick changes, they are fantastic. But we've seen again with COVID that it can have unintended consequences. Mm. What's being proposed here is a complete rethink, but a fundamental investment in untapping the huge resource that is women in our workforce, but also investment in the early years, which would pay dividends for lifetimes and generations, frankly.
Absolutely. I think if COVID has really given us anything, it's the fact that we now have to have a massive overhaul of things like early childhood and also aged care, which are all controlled by the feds, but I guess sort of regulated by the state. So maybe it is a wider conversation around if the state should maybe take back ownership of the things that operate inside Western Australia. But Simone McGuirk, Women's Interest Minister and Child Protection Minister, thank you so very much for your time on The West Live. We'll chat to you again soon.
Thanks, Jenna.
Well, what do you think? Should the government increase the childcare subsidy to get mums back to work? $5 billion for an $11 million insert into the economy doesn't sound too bad, but let me know at thewestlive@wanews.com.au. Speaking of mums, there's currently a young mum stranded in the United Kingdom after travelling there for her dad's funeral. She's now desperate to get home to her family, including her little two-year-old son. But to do that, she's been told by Qatar Airlines she'll have to pay $15,000 to upgrade. Joining me now is aviation editor for the West Australian, Geoffrey Thomas. Geoffrey, is this price gouging?
Look, on the surface of it, Jenna, it would seem to be price gouging, but it's anything but. The problem for the airlines, first of all, the world's airlines are expected to lose $84 billion this year, and their revenues cut by half a trillion dollars. So, I mean, there is blood everywhere when it comes to airlines, as we've seen with Virgin Australia. But let's get back to Qatar and this poor lady's predicament. The situation is the government has, because of the coronavirus outbreak in Victoria, which has spread right around the country, except for Western Australia and Northern Territory, it's capped the number of people who can come into the country. So all of a sudden, Qatar, which has done a remarkable job of keeping the flights around the world going, it's one of the few airlines that have continued to fly and repatriate people, has been forced to cut the number of the flights inbound, a number of people on the flights inbound, down to about 40 or something like 30 or 40 people.
Wow.
Now, that's the problem. So they've got to charge a higher fare because they can't carry all the people that they would normally be carrying. So, you know, their view is, look, you know, we can't make a massive, you know, we're already losing money. We can't make a massive loss on flying these planes basically empty to Perth. We've got to charge a higher fare. And that's what it's all about. So, you know, one could argue that the government, having put these new restrictions on the number of passengers who can fly inbound, they should be footing the bill for these people who are stranded in this particular case. I mean, in one case, they're arguing, well, you've had 6 months to get back. It's your problem. But in this particular case, with this particular lady who went to London for her father's funeral, I understand her circumstance is different. And the government should step in my view, the government should step in and pay the bill.
Yeah, well, I think just to recap, this lovely lady went to the UK for her dad's funeral. It was a planned 10-day round trip. She had a return flight and an exemption all ready to go. And I guess now she just cannot get back because of all of this. So we had, I think I read something on over the weekend that there were only 50 passengers on board an Emirates flight that landed in Perth on Saturday, and only 13 international flights will land in Perth this this week. So in terms of when we say the government should pay, do we say it is it a Qatar? Like, is it there? They have to take care of it? Or I guess how?
No, I'm talking about the Australian government. The Australian government's put the restriction on and they've said, look, you know, because of very, you know, changing circumstances here, we're restricting the number of passengers who can actually fly in. Now, these airlines are saying, well, that's all very well. You want us to keep the lines of communication open. You want us to continue these services. Qantas isn't. Qantas has said, look, hang on, there's no way we can make money on this. We're grounding all our aircraft and we're not flying any international flights at all. So, you know, Qatar and Emirates and others, particularly Qatar, have kept flying, taking food out. They're helping exporters by taking food out as well, chilled lamb and things like that. So, you know, services, they've done an incredible job. But when you all of a sudden say, look, the maximum number of passengers, as you suggest, is 50, then all of a sudden the whole economics of flying, you know, what are very large aeroplanes, just completely go out the door, and they'll be losing a fortune if they didn't charge a higher fare.
Yeah, for sure.
So the view would be, well, in this particular lady's circumstances, I believe she has a claim against the government to say, well, hang on, you know, you slapped this restriction on when I was away. Now I've got to pay this higher fare. It's not fair. And, you know, I think that should be the case.
Yeah, I think she's probably just one of many of these type of stories where, you know, life, there's always going to be little hiccups and things pop up. And I know a lot of people trying to get over east and back home, there's always always going to be things that pop up.
Absolutely, Jenna. There's people everywhere that are falling through the cracks. I mean, the government's done a fantastic job so far, but there are people everywhere that have fallen through the cracks of what they've tried to do.
I guess just focusing on Virgin, we had the news out last week that they will be slashing staff, and also Qantas, as you've said before, are not doing those repatriation flights anymore because it's just not viable. Moving forward, we saw over the weekend that the WA government could be considering not lifting the interstate border until mid-next year, and we're hearing that international trips may be off the menu until at least 2022. Is it viable that Virgin and Qantas can continue?
Look, I believe it is. What they've got to do is focus on intra-state flights. Like, I mean, I know that the Perth Broome service at the moment is one of Qantas's best. So what it needs is some more innovation. Now, you know, both Virgin and Qantas, for instance, should say, well, okay, Perth to Broome's working really well. Why don't we put a new service on Kalgoorlie to Broome? Why don't we put a service on from Albany to Broome, or to Exmouth, or up to the Coral Coast? I mean, there's all sorts of things that they could do now that they have to focus on intrastate flights. I mean, up till a month ago, we were looking at opening our own borders I think it was August the 8th or 18th, something like that.
Yeah.
The Victorian situation just blew that all away.
Yeah.
So the airlines were planning to have interstate flights flowing, and Qantas had said that they would have, by the end of July, 40% of their domestic network operating. Well, the reality is they've got 20% of it operating, and Virgin will be in the same position. So they've got to look at intrastate. They've got to look at within Queensland, within New South Wales, within Western Australia, to try and generate traffic, try to move people around. You know, for instance, you know, the Perth-Kununurra flight's being subsidised by the government. That's fantastic. Mm-hmm. There needs to be more of that to get people, you know, not only just in Perth, but in the regions, as I suggested, you know, Kalgoorlie-Kununurra, Kalgoorlie-Broome. There's people who want to travel, absolutely. The distance, of course, is a huge issue. So, look, I believe they will, you know, both airlines will fly through this. Both are very well financed now, particularly Qantas. I mean, the bottom line is they have to fly through it, and that's all there is to it. And if there was any situation where they weren't, the government would have to step in to support them.
Yeah, for sure. Is Antarctica, I know Qantas are doing a number of flights down to Antarctica, is that travel without really travelling too far? Could that be on the cards for someone like Qantas?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they were doing it with the 747, but all the 747s have now gone. Mm-hmm. So they're now going to do it with 787.
Oh, wow.
Which is actually a fabulous platform. Yes, that was announced late last week.
Mm-hmm.
So they're doing one service from Perth on Australia Day, the 26th of January.
Mm-hmm.
And the 787, with its huge windows, it's almost got, for the size of the number of passengers, it's almost got twice the window area of any other aeroplane.
Wow.
So from a viewing platform perspective, absolutely stunning.
Wow.
Views from a 787. So that will be a really exciting trip to do, and you don't land anywhere.
It's just a bit of a round trip, really.
and for those who are wondering, there's actually six runways down there that you can actually land on, but you don't want to land.
Yeah.
That would be a fabulous trip, and I expect it to sell out very, very quickly.
For sure. Well, aviation editor at the West Australian, Geoffrey Thomas, thank you so much for your time.
Pleasure, Jenna.
Coming up, how did you fare yesterday and into last night with this wild weather? I'll be chatting to the good folks at the Bureau of Meteorology about what's in store for us this week. And Mark Reddings will be in to wrap up the weekend in footy. And speaking of footy, what is going on with everyone having a grope in the change rooms? I'm going to ask him about that coming up.
The West Live. Making news.
That was a weird segue, Matt Timmy.
I don't know how to follow that. It's like, I really hope Jenna doesn't ask me what's going on.
I don't think anyone knows what's going on with those elite athletes.
I think isn't it just schoolboy behaviour that just goes into adulthood, I think?
It's just a bit ridiculous. But speaking of ridiculous, this bizarre hotel quarantine, the security guard, what is going on?
Yeah, so the security guard from the Mercure Hotel is in isolation this morning after this bizarre hotel quarantine breach.
Yeah.
So he was following a task he'd been asked to do, which was to get a TV remote.
Right.
So he busted into a room thinking that room was unoccupied.
Oh.
But a couple was getting ready for bed.
Oh, no.
And they were in quarantine.
Oh, no.
So we have this situation now where he's had to go into isolation. They will have their test on day 12. If it's negative, they'll get to come out on day 14.
Yep.
If his test is positive, they're going to have to do extra time in quarantine.
Oh.
The health department says, look, slim chance that there's any issue here.
Yep.
But it just goes to show you, we have very relaxed restrictions, I suppose, in WA, and how one slip up is all it will take.
Yeah.
So hopefully everybody tests negative in this situation. I don't know how critical the TV remote was.
I was about to say, I don't think it's that.
I'd love to know the backstory behind the request for the TV remote.
Yeah, and busting into a hotel room is no easy feat, considering some of those doors are pretty damn heavy.
I've just got this vision. It's almost like Batman, just like
flying at the door.
Yeah. Corona man.
And then these poor couple just saying they're just brushing their teeth, just minding their own business. Yeah. Like, just two more days, Bob, and we're ready to go home.
It feels like they were getting ready for bed. I think it was more than brushing the teeth.
Yeah.
I'm reading between the lines there
He
busted in.
Now, corona cases, how's the weekend been for us?
We've been good. 4 days without a new case.
Oh, hallelujah.
So that's the first time we've had a zero streak like that in a few weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And we have four active cases. So we have two West Aussies, one from interstate and one from overseas. So
mm-hmm.
all looking good here. In Victoria, the number of cases has dropped, but they've recorded their highest number of daily deaths. So I suppose it's going to we're going to have to see a few more days to see whether this lockdown is having the impact, the masks, all of that.
When do you think that the questions will start become louder? When, there are a couple of weeks into this stage four, or a couple of days into stage four, and the numbers are not falling, as I'm assuming, quickly as the Victorian officials would like. When do you think that the questions are going to start becoming like, well, why are we doing this if the numbers are not moving?
I think it probably needs to be 2 weeks, I think, to give a good effect. Because we had the recommendation over there of masks and the like before the, full shutdown came. So I think a couple of weeks. My sense from people over there is they're kind of any little glimmer of hope, like the number of cases coming down, they're hanging on to. But then when you've got, 19 deaths in a day, It's pretty awful. So I think 2 weeks from the point it came in is probably a good idea to see where things are at.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it looks like people have, on the most part, besides the Karens at the start of all this, have adapted fairly well to it.
Yeah.
You know, talking to my family over there, you know, you can sense they're a bit down about it all.
Mm.
So I just keep throwing the kids on FaceTime at them.
That would definitely cheer anyone up.
To cheer them up.
For sure.
But I'm sure they'll get through it, and just makes, when you just kind of empathise with them, you think, oh God, I do not want a second wave here.
No. And if anything, that probably should help the fact that we just need to remain vigilant over here so we don't have to do
Although, how's that? Might be middle of next year.
That seems a bit scary.
It just seems weird to me that I have no date when I get to see my family again. It's bizarre. Yeah.
It must be really hard.
I think it gets harder not having a date. I think in my head as well, I was thinking Christmas time and then that slipped away and then, oh, it might be end of the year, and then when my account said it might be the middle of next year. My heart sank. I was like, the kids will be starting university before they get to see their grandparents.
Which is not funny. We have fingers crossed that if we all just buckle down and get through this.
Get on top of it.
For sure. Now, this weather, yesterday was quite a windy and blustery sort of day.
Yeah, and even this morning when I was driving into work, I could hardly see in front of me. I almost had to stop on the road and pull over. Not that anyone else was on the road at 2:30 this morning. But we've recorded more than 30 mils of rain since 9 a.m. yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking at more than 15 mils again today. So it's going to be another wet day, possible shower and storm. SES has received more than 80 calls for help. Most of that has come from Perth. Damage to roofs, trees down on cars and houses. So if you're out there today, put your headlights on.
Give it a bit of space on the roads.
Yeah, maybe use your strongest brolly. there's a lot of vision around yesterday of brollies versus the wind and losing out.
I just don't even bother anymore.
Don't you? You just brave it and just run?
Yeah. I walk briskly.
Do you think that you cop more rain if you run or if you walk?
Oh, I don't know.
Galileo or something.
Yeah. Someone that has a major in science.
Yeah.
Well, Matt Tinney from Sunrise, you stay dry and warm today, and fingers crossed you go on FaceTime with the family over Victoria. Be lovely. We'll see you on Sunrise tomorrow and then back on the West Live after that.
Sounds great. Have a great day, Jenna.
Thanks, Maddie. Stick around. We'll be heading to the Wild West where we're going fruit picking. Yes, there's a call out from farmers all around the state that affects every single one of us.
You have the skills, experience,
highly trained specialist
to save a life.
I'm a bloody good surgeon.
Only to be denied because you're a woman.
What else do I have to do to prove myself?
Flashpoint smashes the glass ceiling. Tonight, 8:35 on 7.
WA copped a lashing last night with emergency services receiving 80 calls for help in 24 hours, as Matt Tinney just mentioned. On the line now is James Ashley. He's a duty forecaster at the Bureau of Meteorology. James, a very hairy night for some of us, but what's the forecast for the next couple of days?
G'day, Jenna. Yeah, well, there was a lot of rain around, particularly overnight and early this morning, and really windy conditions yesterday, right across massive part of the state, actually, from the Gascoyne out through Mount Magnet, Cunderdon out that way, all recorded really strong winds, as well as the west coast, and then the rainfall came, and that coast between Carnarvon and Perth, most places there picked up sort of 30 to 50 millimetres, so really decent rainfall through those areas, and it went quite a way inland, so there'll hopefully be some happy pastoralists up in the Gascoyne, and some of the farmers through northern parts of the wheat belt got sort of 10 to 20 millimetres or more as well. As far as what's going to happen from now on in, we've probably seen the worst of the heavy showers, although there's still some decent cells on the radar still to come through.
Mm-hmm.
So mainly just some showers. There still might be a rumble until about lunchtime through the metro area, and then a general easing in conditions over the next 24 hours or so. But we stay in a southwesterly flow, and this time of year when you have those sorts of winds, we're going to pick up showers on and off really for the next couple of days.
Sure. It's been a bit chilly. On a newsflash, Jenna, it's winter. Will the temperatures be dropping as like we saw last week into, the single digits at night and only reaching, say, like 12 during the day?
Well, the forecast looking ahead, we do start seeing, as it clears up, we'll start seeing the minimums drop back into single figures. It is a pretty cold air mass, yeah, you're right. So top of 18 today and tomorrow, and then that just 16 for Wednesday and Thursday as we stay in pretty cool southerly flow. Warms up a little ahead of the next system, which is not going to be all that different to this one, maybe a notch less rainfall and a bit less wind, but that comes through on sort of late Saturday and then into Sunday. Right. We'll see the next frontal system move through.
Is this type of storm, the fact that the cell was so large, is that unusual for this time of year?
The unusual bit about this system was that it extended right across the state. You know, so it put rainfall through, you know, Karratha and out through Kalgoorlie, and the winds ahead of it were really strong through central parts of the state. So it affected a large area. As far as the effects on the sort of southwest corner where we are, that was fairly typical, I guess, the sort of system we see, you know, 4 or 5 times a year.
For sure. Well, duty forecaster at the Bureau of Meteorology, James Ashley, thanks for your time, buddy. You stay warm today.
Thanks, you too. Cheers, Jenna.
And if you're lucky enough to have a day off today, sounds like the perfect time to curl up with a good book and a hot chockey and maybe some footy.
There we go! There's the mark of the year!
Mark Reddings, Channel 7 sports presenter. You must be hoarse after all your weekend of calling the footy.
Yeah, wouldn't change a thing. change a thing, Jenna. No, it was a busy weekend, but loved being at the footy yesterday. Actually, we've got a walk from Belmont Park across the road,
and
it was pouring with rain. I thought, oh, this is going to be just a cyclone, storms. No, I know the duty forecast has been on, and
yeah.
We thought, could be 3 inches of rain during the game.
Yeah.
Not one drop, and there was sunshine in the third, fourth quarter, so we went, what is going on here? All these people with ponchos, they're sitting on the outer side in sunshine. So, but we were happy to get through that little period. But
for sure.
Absolutely.
What's it like in Optus Stadium when there is really strong winds and a lot of rain around? Because it seems to be, the roof seems to come over.
Yeah, I think it's just a swirly scenario. If you've been to the MCG, the same scenario where the breeze isn't a factor, but it swirls and the wind and the rain all collaborates and it becomes just a bit cold and messy. But it wasn't a bad game of footy.
How about them Eagles?
Yeah, they're going well. 6 wins in a row. They know that in a few weeks they'll have to head back to Queensland most likely for that hub.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the best winning run for a team this season, 6 in a row. It shows you points in the bank at home. And Carlton were pretty good.
Yeah.
They were terrific. A couple of things we have to touch on. The umpiring. And now, this is not a personal attack on any umpire, because what they've had to deal with this season with regards to tinkering of the rules and holding the ball particularly is baffling. Because yesterday, Carlton, I thought, was smashed by the umpires on a couple of occasions. A guy called Petrescu Seaton was penalised for holding the ball early in the match. And that was the one moment when I was sitting with Glenn Jakovich and Carl Langdon and we said, we do not understand the rules of the game anymore. And this is a common theme across the AFL. A guy called Peter Schwab, who used to be the umpire's coach, he's come out and said, the holding the ball rule, I simply don't understand it anymore. So this is one of the big issues I think that umpires and the AFL has to deal with, because it's making our game almost unwatchable at times.
So for those of us that may not be tapped in, so what's the new rule?
Well, in essence, it's hard to explain in this scenario, but the ball comes to Jenna, you grab the ball, you're immediately tackled. The ball is trapped around your waist, etc. You're holding, can't get rid of it. You had no time. It used to be prior opportunity, at least a chance to try and hand pass or kick. That's not happening at times now. So there's a real confusion amongst spectators, commentators and the players.
Yeah.
The guy, Petrescu Seaton, who gave up the penalty yesterday, there's a bit of mouthing off, 50-metre penalty. So the frustration boils over. So that shouldn't disguise the fact that West Coast were fantastic. Dom Sheedy's a beautiful left-foot kick and he's elite. So's Tim Kelly. They've got a lot of upside. And I know that if they're in that one game, last Saturday in September, the mid-October Saturday at the Gabba, they might be there.
The bloody Gabba. So do you reckon you're in with all of the who's who. What's the latest rumours swirling around?
Well, I think if you're doing a market, they're the warm favourites, Brisbane and the Gabba per se. The venue's horrible.
Shit ass.
But can you say that? You can say
Why
that.
Why not?
But it is certainly nowhere near Optus Stadium. But I guess in many ways our restrictions with quarantining becomes a factor as well, more so than Queensland, to my understanding. Well, that can change, but I would suggest that let's put it aside that Queensland likely to be the grand final host this year.
Mm-hmm. Fine. Fine. One thing I need to talk to you about specifically, this groping issue. What, I mean, Hugh Remington brought it up with Damien Hardwick from the Tigers the other night and they kind of dismissed it. Now, the vision shows just they're in the huddle after the game, bit of tapping. You normally see it on the field after a goal, like, great job, bro, whatever. Can you explain what's going on and is there an outcry or is it just the social media vacuum?
A bit of both, I think. Okay. And look, it's hard because, I'm a bit older than you, but you go back to, and I was talking again to some of the Eagles who were part of the 1990s era.
Yeah.
And that sort of stuff happened so regularly in the rooms amongst teammates who knew each other, and it was all banter and fun. Now, what we consider, or they considered banter back 30 years ago now, is causing controversy and friction amongst people who think it's bordering on sexual assault. Now, I can't see it going, I can't buy that argument, but inappropriate, perhaps it is. Cameras are always there. Put it this way, I'm a guy, so I'm a little bit, I sort of looked at it and went, you know, silly, don't do it again, but I don't think there should be any punishment. I think just a warning. So, but you look, from a female perspective?
Well, I just think it's odd from a female perspective. Like, it's not like you see, you know, the netty girls all around at the super netty just smacking each other on the genitals when you get a goal or
But they don't do that they might tap each other on the ground, but this was, the song was being sung. Now, I'm not condoning it for one moment, but I think it sounds like boys being boys and stupidity.
Is this a legitimate excuse to use that real great Trump quote of like, it's just locker room talk?
Well, I'll get in trouble for saying this, but it is. And you know what? It's a lesson learned. I can tell you now, it won't be happening going forward. So maybe that's just the where we're at with this type of behaviour. And I'm not sure the big fella Chole was overly impressed by it. He didn't look comfortable with that. That's the issue.
I think that was the issue. It's not if it's all fun and games and everyone's having fun, but if someone looks uncomfortable, it's probably best to keep your hands to yourself.
Yeah, and look, I've seen a picture of Georgie Parker, who's a former Hockey Roo, got a screenshot of her.
Yeah.
Hard to explain again, but they're lining up for the national anthem. There's a picture of her with her hand on a teammate's backside or thereabouts. That's her screenshot. Again, that's it's interesting territory we're heading into, Jenna. But to give you the answer, I think you're right. We've come to the conclusion that Chole looked uncomfortable in that moment. Therefore, perhaps that's probably a step too far.
Yeah. I'd be interested to see, like you said, like former or our current athletes, because I guess no one knows what it's like in that pressure cooker environment. And if that's, you know, part of the culture, then
I don't think it's part of the culture. I think it was, it's unusual. I don't think we see that every week, as you know, but it was Hugh Remington. I was fascinated to listen to the banter with him and Damien Hardwick.
If Hugh Remington walked into your press conference, you would be very, very concerned. So I'm surprised they didn't really notice that at the start. So it was an interesting exchange, that's for sure.
Absolutely. Our Fremantle play Hawthorn tonight, by the way, at Optus Stadium. So
Hogan's still not in.
No, Hogan's heroes tonight. He's going to be sitting on the sidelines. The car, I think it's okay, but it's going to be a bit wet. So I suspect they're going to go with a smaller team. Hill, H come into the side, give them some run. And they've got a bit of a hoodoo against the Hawks. So hopefully Freo fans get along, support your team.
For sure. And a 6:30 on 7, mate. And we'll have a full wrap-up from you, I'm assuming, in Sunrise tomorrow morning.
Absolutely. Can't wait for it.
Fabulous. Mark Reddings from 7 Sport. Thank you so very much.
Thanks, Jenna.
The Wild West.
Ben O'Shea.
Jenna, how are you?
Good morning, my friend.
You know what? It's so interesting, this groping in the change rooms. It's a bit icky.
What do you make of it?
It's a bit icky, to be honest. But and look, what Skeet was saying there, like, you know, you don't want to sort of fob it off as, you know, boys will be boys or, you know, locker room talk or anything like that. But I can tell you, growing up playing sport, that, you know, sporting trips, all boys school, sporting teams, this type of weirdness is not uncommon. Like, it's, I think people are kidding themselves if they do not think that boys growing up playing sport aren't doing this type of stuff all the time.
It's really weird. Is it a psychological thing? Is it a primitive thing?
All of the above. Like, I've often found it quite weird and uncomfortable as a kid when that type of stuff was going on. But it happens all the time. It's happening right now.
It's happening. Weird. Grown men.
Grown men doing it. The difference is it's very rarely caught on TV.
Yes.
That's the difference with this particular occasion. And I'd like, if it's an opportunity to talk about it, then that's probably good.
Yeah, you know? For sure. Now, what is making news from the Wild East to the very Wild West? What's making news in our little pocket of the world today?
So a woman in Kalbalda has been arrested and she's been fined $800 after picking up a package from the post office that was meant for her neighbour. So she's got the little slip in the letterbox that says you have a parcel waiting for you at the post office. Obviously it wasn't for her. It was put in her letterbox by mistake. Mm-hmm. It should have gone to her neighbour. She's regardless, taken it down to the post office and claimed the item, which, you know, you can't do that. She didn't do it to give it to her neighbour as an altruistic act. She, you know, pocketed the item, basically, which turned out to be pretty pointless for her because it was a pet odour sanitizer that had arrived in the mail that was worth a princely sum of $44.80, and this woman didn't even have a pet.
No, why?
Yeah, so she was obviously hoping it was going to be something a bit better than a pet odour sanitizer.
And now she's been slugged $800 for it.
Yeah, well, she apparently felt embarrassed about the whole situation, which is why she didn't return the thing, which she'd taken really fraudulently. And then when she's rocked up at the Australian Post Office a couple of days later, the post office staff have recognised her, called the police, and she's been arrested. So,
whoa.
So there you go. So it's pretty serious.
That is
fraud. Escalated very, very much
quickly.
So. And the magistrate said she didn't really have any track record of doing the wrong thing or substance abuse or anything like that, but it was still a serious matter. And so he slugged the $800.
Oh, that is an expensive. That's a good haul on the Iconic or something like that.
Exactly. You can buy a lot of pet odour sanitizers for $800.
And given Australia Post, you know, delivers, probably feels like once every 3 months here at the moment, like you'd be pretty happy to see something arrive.
Exactly. Exactly.
Now, WA families being urged to pick their own fruit. This is a pretty interesting story. I was speaking to one of the ag reporters in the newsroom yesterday about it. What are we being encouraged to do?
Yeah. So the Sunday Times reported yesterday that Perth strawberry growers in the first instance are the ones who are going to be hit. Like they're going to see about $15 million worth of their crop just left to rot.
I could eat at least $13 million worth.
Well, they want people like you, Jenna, to go out to Bullsbrook and out that way and pick your own strawberries, because the problem is they don't have enough manpower because of COVID. Like you're talking, the strawberry industry, I think, is something like 1,500 backpackers or something like that they need to get the crop off the vines?
Yeah,
the
they're
plants,
vines. Yeah, you do have
them?
To bend over quite a lot.
Yeah. I did it once. It was a hot day in summer. It was like, it was scorching out in Bullsbrook and it was dusty and dirty.
Not a lot of shade.
I got a lot of amazing strawberries, but
I was too tired to eat them.
Yeah, exactly. And then after about a kilo, I was like, you know what? I like another strawberry for a year. So it does things to the
and
human
then on the way home,
system.
you hit up the Macca's on the drive through to get a strawberry milkshake because you can't be bothered touching them.
Exactly. Exactly. But don't be put off by that story. You need to go out there because there's something like 9,000 tonnes of strawberries. Can you believe it? 9,000 tonnes of strawberries that needs to be harvested between August and November. And they're just not going to be harvested unless people – and it's a fun thing for a family to do. Go out, pick a 10-kilo tray of strawberries.
Amazing.
Put them into smoothies, freeze them, whatever you need to do.
Yeah.
But going forward, though, like you're looking towards October when a lot of crops start to come into season. So you're talking avocados, bananas, blueberries in summer, you got all the stone fruit, cherries, oranges, all that kind of stuff. So I'm wondering, will we see the farmers capitalize on the wander out yonder and get people from Perth down into these regional areas and have that as part of their school holidays this October and September?
I wonder if there's an interesting side hustle project, if they're going to offer, you know, like we'll come down south for a weekend and you can have your board taken care of, just come and pick, you know, do 8 hours of work and then...
Well, exactly. That's what we need to be talking about right now, because otherwise these farmers are going to be really struggling and even worse, you know, the food's just all this food, great food, great produce is just going to go to waste.
Absolutely.
Which is sad. It's sad to see.
Yeah.
And even if it's charities maybe going down and picking them and for, you know, sort of food rescue organisations up here in Perth, maybe that's something to consider.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You're an ideas man, Ben,
you know, get the footy players instead of groping
nice
instead of groping a bunch of grapes in the change room.
They seem to have
send them down to be
Not too tight on avocados.
Exactly. They're perfect for the job.
For sure. That is a very good idea. Ben O'Shea, thank you so very much for joining us in the Wild West. We'll see you on the West Live tomorrow.
We'll see you tomorrow.
That's it from me. We'll be back at 8:45 over on thewest.com.au/live. We're also available to listen to on Perth Now. And we have a catch up over on thewest.com.au from 12:30 today. Have a lovely day. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to The West Live with Jenna Clark. If the story behind the story matters to you, then you can count on thewest.com.au to deliver.
It's the podcast that has Australia captivated. Claremont, The Trial. We take you inside the courtroom with over 3 million downloads already. Catch up on Claremont, The Trial at thewest.com.au or where you get your podcasts.